You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
And I thank you for coming this morning to join us about a conversation about the wall, border security, and many issues such as immigration, the U.S. economy, and security issues surrounding the wall. I want to thank our fantastic communications team for preparing the video that you just saw, and also further images that you will see. President Trump started 2018 by again renewing his calls for the wall on the U.S. southern border with Mexico. This was one of his key campaign promises, at the time calling for a brick and cement structure running the entire length of the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border, and arguing that Mexico will pay the price tag for the wall. Recently, some of the administration's wording has changed, including that the structure could look like more like a fence. There are some indications that the president might prefer a see-through structure, and as well that perhaps the barrier might not run the entire 2,000-mile length. You saw some of the very difficult terrain in the previous images and how difficult that is to do, and that it might merely replace the existing 700-mile fence, perhaps with some 200-mile extension, at least in the initial 10 years, with a price tag that the administration estimates correctly at $18 billion. U.S. dollars, of course. There are vast differences in the price estimates, and that's something that we can talk about in the question and answer period, but it is probably a safe guess that $18 billion is a significant underestimate of the actual cost, especially if one factors in the need for repairing the structure, as is always the case. And it also implies very difficult and highly problematic trade-offs, such as taking money away from the Coast Guard for far more vital security elements. And the president has once again suggested that Mexico will pay for the border wall, which it will not. There is no way to make Mexico pay for the wall, nor is it at all politically feasible for any Mexican government to agree to such a proposition, especially in a presidential election year. But far more fundamentally, the wall is not simply about the money that are being spent. It entails many other costs that go far beyond the financial cost, and it's not going to accomplish the promises that the president has made. It will not enhance UN security. It will not stop contraband or people reaching the United States, and it's not going to improve U.S. economic well-being. While it will fail at great expense in those costs and great opportunity costs, it comes with other problems, such as hurting the lives of U.S. border communities, Native American communities, as well as damaging the environment. Why will the wall not stop the flow of drugs? For the very same reason, the existing fence doesn't stop it. Traffickers will simply go above, under, and over it. They will use technologies such as drones and catapults to throw drugs over, and they will build tunnels that go under the wall. Even if the land border could somehow be made more secure and these technologies were not available, traffickers would simply smuggle people and goods and trucks by boats, as is already happening and as traditionally was the case, going far down the U.S. coast, far up the U.S. coast, I should say. And crucially, drugs and contraband, as well as people being smuggled into the United States, will go through the legal ports of entry, of which there are 52. The vast majority of the amount of drugs smuggled into the United States from Mexico that doesn't come by mail, such as fentanyl from China, comes through the legal ports of entry. These ports of entry process literally millions of people, cars, trucks, and trains every week. It's simply not physically feasible to check all this movement of people and goods, even if improving the quality and speed efficiency of searches at ports of entry is crucial, far more important than any physical structure between the ports of entry. Why will the wall not enhance U.S. security from criminal groups? Because security at the end of the day is far more crucially dependent on good cooperation with Mexico. Already today, Mexico turns many more undocumented Central Americans, often very unfortunate people who come to try to the United States, than what's turned at the US-Mexico border. If Mexico drops this cooperation, that was very hard to achieve and took a long time, many more people would be attempting to cross into the United States. Similarly, cooperation or security against drug trafficking groups, criminal groups, very much depends on the United States finally being able to build up good cooperation, intelligence sharing, ability to mount joint coordinated actions, and also crucially the capacity of the United States law enforcement institutions to work with their colleagues in Mexico to help reduce the corruption and increase the efficiency of those law enforcement institutions in Mexico. All of that will be lost if the administration resorts to very hostile relations, very hostile environment with Mexico. Building up this cooperation took decades. It was very difficult, and there were some very very cold moments in the U.S.-Mexico relations, and people like Ambassador Tony Wayne in the audience worked very hard to improve that cooperation. That could easily be lost. Far more important, in fact, than security from trafficking is counterterrorism cooperation, and that's something that the United States and Mexico always enjoyed, even during those cold, difficult times. But that also involves, in fact, security, enhancing capacity of institutions such as U.S. Coast Guard. The far greater terrorist threat is not someone crossing the border from Mexico, but very dangerous equipment reaching, for example, U.S. ports. Yet, the president wants to take money away from the Coast Guard, from other institutions such as Border Patrol, and to devote it to the physical structure, by far the least efficient, least significant element of border security. Why will the wall not reduce crime in the United States? Because violent crime in the U.S. is not in any significant way linked to legal or illegal immigration into the United States. Although the President Trump has repeatedly railed against the carnage of crime in U.S. cities, overall, U.S. Violent crime has gone substantially down. We are far lower than we were at any point since 1991, with the exception of 2015, when three cities experienced significant spikes in homicides, driving homicides increases in the entire country: Baltimore, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. has since improved. Chicago has slightly improved. Baltimore this year has the highest per capita murder rate in a long time. But in none of the three cities, it was immigration or whether documented or undocumented immigrants that drove the rise in violent crime. Rather, what the three cities had in common were high income and racial inequality, declining population, high poverty and unemployment rates well above the national average, and very historically troubled relations between residents and police. These conditions are conducive to rise in crime. There is no evidence whatsoever that undocumented residents account for a significant amount of crime, violent crime, in the United States. In fact, the vast majority of criminological studies consistently show that most homicides and most violent crime in the U.S. at several times the rate is perpetrated by native-born Americans. Instead, it is the kind of anti-community policing that the Trump administration is promoting, attacking sanctuary cities, which, such as New York, have far lower homicide rates than many non-sanctuary cities, pardoning police lawbreakers such as Sheriff Arpaio, and crucially forcing local police departments to prioritize raids in Latino communities, hunting down even peaceful, productive, undocumented residents that jeopardize years of improvements in U.S. law enforcement and years of improvement in violent crime in the country. There is powerful and consistent evidence across the United States, and in fact across all countries, that if people begin to question the fairness, equity, and legitimacy of enforcement, they stop reporting crime. And when they stop reporting crime, homicides increase. Thus, in fact, the policing practices and immigration raids that the president promotes are very likely to worsen crime in the United States. Why will the wall not help the U.S. economy or U.S. workers? Yes, there is some evidence that immigration has some negative effects on a small segment of the U.S. population, namely high school dropouts and prior immigrants. They often compete for the very same jobs as low-skill jobs as the newest immigrants that arrive. However, the right response for those small segments of population that are negatively affected in terms of employment and wages is, of course, to help them with vocational training, with providing them with medical insurance and other capacity to locate jobs that are more productive and more rewarding. To a large extent, undocumented workers work the unpleasant, backbreaking jobs that Native American workers, that native-born workers, are not willing to perform. In agriculture, in seafood processing factory, in landscaping, or taking care of the elderly and the terminally ill, often very psychologically demanding jobs, as well as hard physical jobs. These economic sectors will be hurt by mass deportations, but also the quality of life in the U.S., the quality of U.S. society will be affected. Crucially, however, immigrant workers have a very important net positive effect on the economy. The native-born population is declining both in numbers and in productivity. At the same time, the longevity is increasing. What it, of course, means is that immigrants and their children will account for the vast majority of the future and current labor force growth, unless, of course, the president gets his way and significantly reduces also legal migration. In that case, however, there will be very significant burdens in terms of expensive benefits such as Medicare and Social Security. Essentially, we need migrants now to pay for those benefits so that we, you, I, in the future can enjoy them, having paid for them. And in fact, undocumented workers contribute, they often pay Social Security, even though they might not be able to draw the benefits of those payments later in the future. NAFTA too, which is currently under renegotiations, and the president has repeatedly threatened to withdraw from it, has not siphoned off large amount of U.S. jobs. Yes, it has caused some dislocation and forced some workers to find other jobs, but it's created many others. The estimates vary, but perhaps today as many as 5 million jobs depend on NAFTA. Crucially, however, NAFTA not only creates new jobs, it also enables the creation of integrated value production lines across Mexico, the United States, and Canada, which make U.S. companies more competitive, and that creates jobs. But it also allows for the importation of cheaper goods. If NAFTA ended, some of the most disadvantaged U.S. Citizens, those who voted for President Trump, the lower middle class white families, will pay the greatest burden for an end to NAFTA because a variety of consumer goods will become far more expensive. And certain segments of the economy, such as manufacturing and farming, would be particularly badly hurt. Car manufacturers, farming today are crucial dependents on exports to Mexico and Canada. But there are other costs that we often don't hear very much about. And that's, for example, native communities. You saw pictures beforehand. There are 26 federally recognized native communities in the U.S., 8 indigenous people in Mexico who live along the border. The wall, already the existing fence, cuts through their tribal homelands. It separates family members from their relatives, and it damages their sacred sites and separates them from their sacred sites. And it also damages the natural environment, which is very much part of their heritage. The border area, places of Big Bend that you saw images from, as well as the so-called Sky Islands in the Arizona-New Mexico area, are some of the greatest biodiversity places in the United States, with perhaps 100 species of animals endangered. The wall does not merely affect those U.S. border communities and the border physical environment. It has deep reach into the United States. It is not simply about the physical structure, but about the very nature of society that the United States want to live in. The wall, as the president embraces it, with his attacks on Muslims and other communities, with his resentment toward NAFTA, is not simply about creating a physical structure, but about creating barriers and divisions in one's mind and promoting politics of exclusion and bigotry, the very opposite of the American creed. If I might ask you to join me on the podium. Will you do the introduction? Will you introduce yourself and the congressman?
Okay.
I think you are in the middle, and I'm here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. We're hoping that it's going to be an exciting panel. It's certainly timely. It's been in the news all week long. It'll probably be in the news as the debate gets going on all the different bills for a DACA fix. So there's a lot of things that are get intertwined here, and we're hoping that we'll shed some light on the deeper issues that are underlying the discussion over the border wall or border security. And then we want to hear from you guys what your concerns are, what your questions are, and hopefully the congressman will be able to shed some light into the behind the scenes that's going on. He was at the White House with 25 other lawmakers, meeting with President Trump, talking about budget talks to avert a government shutdown, finding a common ground to provide relief or legalization for Dreamers, as well as also strengthening border security. So we're hoping that you take away a lot of important ideas and thoughts about what's going on the Hill and at the White House, and most importantly, along the border. So thank you, and let's get it going. So I thought we would begin the discussion just basically by explaining what's going on in terms of basic things like definitions, Vanda. You talked about border security. You understand something very differently than the president apparently does in terms of what does border security do. So I thought we would begin by just getting to definitions. So we're going to talk about all the issues you raised in your essay and right now. We talk about, you know, what problem is the wall really trying to solve if border crossings are down, if drug traffickers will continue to evade authorities or finding ways to get their drugs in. Eminent domain, you know, there are 90 lawsuits that are still pending, according to your account. And all obviously the evolving nature of the threats to U.S. security, like terrorism and drug trafficking. So first of all, definitions. What does the president mean by the border wall? How do you achieve operational control of the border? And is $18 billion enough? What is the actual price tag when you get done with maintenance and repairs and so forth?
Well, thank you. I'll let you, Congressman, speak about what the president means by the wall. You most recently were with him. Clearly, his view has changed. I mentioned in my opening remarks that for a long time during the campaign and into his first year, he appeared to be insisting on a brick and cement physical structure. There perhaps is some movement now and suggestions that he prefers some see-through structure. And the administration, as far as I know, has never specified what it conceives by border security. It has never provided a definition. I would, however, argue that a lot of border security does not take place at the border. In fact, takes place far away from the border. both in terms of screening of people who come to the U.S. on visas, for example, but also in terms of cooperation with countries that could be sources of flows, dangerous flows to the United States, and cooperation with neighbors. I spoke about the necessary cooperation with Mexico and the fact that a lot of the control takes place actually on the Mexico-Central America border. I spoke about the long-term U.S.-Mexico counterterrorism cooperation that survived decades of even very, very difficult relationship with intelligence agencies sharing information and being able to apprehend potentially suspicious or dangerous individual far away from the border, in fact, at the territory. So a lot of border security takes place very far away from the border. And the physical structure on the border itself is merely a very temporary delay at best for any flows of either dangerous contraband or people.
First of all, thank you so much for allowing me to be here with y'all and in the Brookings Institute. Again, thank you for allowing us to be here. I also want to point out somebody in the audience. I think the ambassador is back there, Anthony Wayne. And I say this because I learned a lot from him when he was the Mexican ambassador. And let me talk about some of the points. When we met with the president, I told the president, let me use a football analogy about the border. If you use football as an analogy, are you going to play defense on the one-yard line, which we call the the U.S.-Mexico border? And we spend right now $18 billion roughly on border security when you include everything. The president wants to add $18 billion for a fence, keeping in mind that we spend $18 billion total right now for border security.
That's the budget for CBP? Or
CBP, ICE, anything we spend on the border when you combine it all together. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to play defense, and I say offense also, you have to go, using football as an analogy, play on their 20-yard line instead of the one-yard line. What does that mean? Exactly what you said. You expand the perimeter, and that is you work with countries that can help you. When people talk about the southern border strategy, I always remind this, and Tony, this might look familiar, is the southern border strategy that Mexico has with Guatemala. Mm-hmm. Because if you're trying to stop things from coming in, you use their 20-yard line instead of your one-yard line where we spend so much money on the U.S. border. If you're able to do that, and you, I think you mentioned also, is Mexico at times has stopped more people and deported more people than what the U.S. Border Patrol. So if they would play matador, a bullfighter, and say, ole, just go in, that means all those people who are trying to come in will be over here at the Border Patrol. And remember, some of the people that are coming in at the border, some of them will come through a bridge. Some of them are going to come in between. Some of them are going to try to evade. Mm-hmm. Some of them are not going to evade because they're going to come in and say credible fear, asylum, or use one of those legal resources that they have. So they can use those. So not all of them are going to try to evade. So you got to understand, what are you trying to stop?
And Congressman, how much money has U.S. devoted to that southern, the Mexico southern border strategy?
Well, keep in mind, people talk about foreign aid. And notice when I talked about helping Mexico, back in 2014 when the unaccompanied kids, Kate Ranger and myself, we added about $80 million. With those $80 million to help Mexico in the southern border, they actually did a pretty good job. Remember, $80 million compared to $18 billion. So we got to know what to work with them. But if you look at the budget, for example, and I don't want to get into foreign aid, but I just want to give you a perspective. There's five countries what I call the $1 billion club. Israel gets more money than any other country, $3.1 billion plus. You got Pakistan, but that's being rolled back by the president. Then you got Egypt, and then at one time you had Iraq, now it's Afghanistan, and Jordan. So you got about five countries that are what I call the $1 billion club. But in our own backyard, before we did Plan Merida, we were giving Mexico about $36 million. And now it's a little bit over $100 million. It doesn't make sense that we should, if we're going to secure ourselves, work with Mexico and Southern America, and I mean Central America. And one of the things that we did, for example, when the Young Incompetent Kids, we worked in appropriations and we put $750 million to help the Central American countries, prosperity, security, build up those countries so, you know, less folks will have to come in because we're securing those countries. And unfortunately, the present administration, with all due respect, doesn't look at that. They just want to play a one-yard line defense and not look at. And I'll say this also about Mexico. If Mexico plays the Matador position, that is, okay, you guys want to get rid of NAFTA, you all are you know, trying to put a wall, you're trying to attack us, call us rapists and murderers and all that, look at what Mexico does. Besides what they're doing at the southern border, which I think we can help and do more, the visa system that Mexico has is set up to help us. Imagine if one day the Mexicans say, hey, we're going to start letting the North Koreans come in vacation in Acapulco, or we're going to let Iran send all their folks over here. So they keep away folks that we don't want into the U.S. So the visa system helps us. The law enforcement people, ICE, DEA, and other officers that we have there are there working with us and working with the Mexicans, should I say. So they do a lot on security. So when we talk about NAFTA, I know we're talking about border, but when we talk about NAFTA, people need to keep in mind that those countries help us with security. The last point I want to point, if you talk to some of the Central American countries or even, you know, talk to our own officials here, in the past, people thought that the only people coming in were Mexicans. Everything were Mexicans. But if you look at it, it's almost a UN. If you look at the people coming in, without mentioning countries, I can give you countries across the world that are now coming in through that. So that's why we got to work with Mexico. We got to work with other countries, Central America, to make sure that we extend our security, not at the one-yard line, but do the pre-screening and the other work that we do. And that's where the administration, I brought this up to the president. And what did he say? Oh, you know, people just want money. We can, you know, we don't need to give them money. That's our money. And, you know, and this is what we're saying is we got to understand what are we trying to stop. Last point. If you're trying to stop people coming into the United States, keep in mind that if you built the most beautiful wall, according to the president, 40% of the people that are here without documents are through a legal permit or visa. Visa overstays. So you can build the wall, somebody's gonna come in a ship, cross a bridge, or come by airplane and overstay. So a wall is not gonna stop them. Mm-hmm. You're gonna stop drugs. Look at the latest DEA report. If you're talking about land, where are they coming through? Ports of entry. Mm-hmm. I represent Laredo, Texas, which is the largest inland port in the country. And after LA, total trade, it's Laredo. Little town of 250,000. But we handle most of the trade coming in from Mexico through that land port. We've been trying to get more money into the ports, but most of the money goes between ports because most of my colleagues that don't understand the border want to put it in Border Patrol, which I support Border Patrol, men and women in green. They want to add a wall and National Guard. That's basically their solution. But if you look at it, you got to have the men and women in blue, which are the CBP officers. Those are the ones that we have at the ports. You got to have the technology, not only between ports, but also at the ports of entry, because that's where drugs are coming in. Mm-hmm. So to conclude this point, you got to know what you're trying to do. And if you don't know what you're trying to stop or how it's coming in, and I don't even touch the water, because the drug dealers, you know, they're not backwards type of individuals. They're rather sophisticated. Or should I say, they are sophisticated, and they hire people that are sophisticated, and they'll use drones to do certain things. They'll use the catapults that you talked about. They'll use submarines to bring in drugs and speedboats plus other things, and they will adjust. In the 1980s, when Miami Vice, remember Miami Vice, what was the drugs coming in? They were coming in through Florida and those areas. The U.S. put a lot of pressure. Some of us used to say, hey, it's like, you know, it's like you push a balloon in and it's going to come over here. And sure enough, it started coming to the southern border. So they're going to adjust because they're sophisticated organizations.
So on that point, Vanda, talk about, you know, the president says that he's a successful businessman. That's his background. And he, at times, has been criticized for trying to run the country like he ran his businesses, right? So when you talk about an $18 billion initial investment, because obviously the cost is going to be much higher when we're done with this, so what kind of return on the, on investment is he getting for that $18 billion border wall?
Well, Maria, I think that it's clear by now that both the congressman and I believe that he is getting a very poor return on that investment. And you said appropriately that the $18 billion is the initial cost to build the structure. A big ironic part, of course, is that it's meant to replace right now about 700 miles of an existing structure that is there in the first place. But, of course, that requires then that there will be repairs. We also are not fully clear what will actually be on the wall. The physical structure itself is the least important element. What is far more important in terms of even just reducing the amount of time that people or goods have to cross the border is the sensors that are along the border, lights, and there's been very little specification of what actually will there be in terms of radar, signal intelligence, and other sensor element of security that are far more crucial, again, than just the physical 18-foot, 30-foot structure. And in fact, there is, I think, rather distressing evidence that the president is proposing, or the White House is proposing, to reuse those sensor technology platform elements of the security and to put more money into the physical structure. So once
Is that because in the budget for fiscal year 2019, apparently there's a memo out there where the White House officials were saying, let's take down funding for those areas and increase it for the border wall?
Yes, indeed, and there have been other reports about some of the budgetary trade-offs that are being made. I alluded to shortchanging the Coast Guard and relocating money from the Coast Guard toward the wall. Again, I think that is extraordinary poor choice in terms of far greater dangers to the country's security, namely terrorism threats, the threat of some major terrorist activity in a port in a place like Boston or New York is far more significant, or Baltimore is far more significant than the land, drug crossings, or even crossings of immigrants across the border. So, you know, my take is that we're taking the least effective element of border counterterrorism security, U.S. Homeland Security, and giving it tremendous amount of money that amounts to often a waste of money.
And Vanda, you know, and also the congressman, you know, he won, he campaigned and he won on the pledge to build the wall and have Mexico pay for it. Obviously, things didn't go well. He didn't invite the Mexican president over to the White House, and then things went downhill from there. And then he kind of laid back from that pledge, but he brought it up again this week. He again said, oh, and by the way, Mexico will pay for it somehow. Why, if we all know that realistically Mexico is not going to pay for the wall, why do you think he keeps bringing that up in his rhetoric toolbox?
Well, obviously, he believes that that is a way to persuade Congress to and taxpayers to lay out those extraordinary expenses for the wall, that somehow it will come back into future. It will not come back from Mexico into future. The president has previously spoken about seizing, for example, remittances that go to Mexico and Central America. That is neither legally nor forensically at all easy to do. In fact, it's very difficult to do, and arguably it cannot be done, even if there were capacity to sort money, for example, from undocumented workers. But also, even if somehow you could go through the enormous enterprise of trying to sort remittances that come from undocumented people, from documented people that would, in fact, be very counterproductive in terms of security in the United States and in terms of the president's own objective, such as to limit immigration, legal and illegal, into the United States. For Mexico, remittances are the third most important source of revenue. And for Central America, that is often even a greater share. It's often number one source of revenue or very important source of revenue in some countries amounting to a third of the GDP. A reduction of remittances from the United States to those countries would mean far greater impoverishment, far greater economic hardship, and hence also far greater opportunities for criminal gangs such as the Maras and Pandillas, as well as drug trafficking organizations to intimidate and terrorize people. So if in year one we suppress remittances for whatever reason to those countries, in year 1.5, year two, we can in fact expect far greater number of people trying to make it into the United States.
And Vanda, share with us what are the major differences between what happened back in 2006 when President Bush signed into law the Secure Fence Act. I have in my notes here that 26 Democratic senators voted for it, including then Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, and Joe Biden and Schumer. What are the big differences between what happened then and the kind of debate that we're having now over a border wall?
Well, there are some differences, and of course there are some similarities, including one that has potentially emerged very surprisingly this week. Part of the Secure Fence Act narrative of the George W. Bush administration, was, of course, that there would be a comprehensive immigration reform and that securing the border to reduce the flows of immigrants across the border would be the first step, which would then allow bipartisan work in the Congress to achieve comprehensive immigration reform. That didn't happen. The Obama administration had its own replay, and although it did not build a new fence along the border, it invested substantially in bringing remote technology, so-called virtual border elements, to parts of the division, parts of the border. It was not as comprehensive as was envisioned in the original planning, but nonetheless, a lot of technological assets, visibility assets that allow for more rapid response were put at the border at the time. And the Obama administration also engaged in the deportation of a lot of people from the United States.
Close to 3 million.
For a while, President Obama was called the deporter-in-chief. In his last 2 years of the administration, most of the people who were deported were either voluntary returns, so they were not deported, but people who were caught close to the border within a short amount of time, and people who, in fact, had criminal records. They were the vast majority of deportees in the last 2 years. But both the deportations, the virtual border of the Obama administration, was once again to pave the ground for bipartisan support for comprehensive immigration reform. Once again, just like during George W. Bush administration, that fell through.
And that's perfect for the next set of questioning that I had. Congressman, you know, we're talking about two sets of deadlines coming up. We have the January 19th deadline when government will run out of money and Congress needs to either do another CR, you know, continuous resolution, or find a longer-term budget deal to avert a government shutdown. We also have the March 5th deadline that President Trump is imposing on Congress to find a DACA fix. So we have those two things going on. But we throw in the mix the ruling from the Ninth Circuit this week, where basically it's saying it's illegal to stop the DACA program. These kids need to continue renewing their permits while litigation gets sorted out in the system, in the court system. Talk about how that affects the timelines that we're dealing with on the Hill.
Well, first of all, I sit on the Homeland Appropriations and the Defense Appropriations, so we work a whole year on getting the budget. And most of our work is done already. Are we waiting for my Republican friend so we can work out a deal? Is what we call the top numbers. The top numbers is basically if you add $1 for new dollars for defense, we want to have $1 for non-defense appropriations. And I think the last numbers we saw Republicans wanted to have $54 billion new dollars to defense and about $37 billion for non-defense, which includes everybody else except for the defense. So we're trying to get that up so we can do that. Now, there was a proposal yesterday of a two-year deal, which is the way we ought to do it, because once you get those top numbers, our work is done. All we have to do is increase certain things. What makes it a little different this time, and I don't like CRs, and if there's any government employees or anybody here, nobody likes the CRs because that means we haven't done our job. The reason we haven't done our job because for some reason our friends haven't given us that number, and part of it because they were busy with the tax bill. And I thought that after the tax bill, we'll get the numbers, because once you get those numbers, our job will be done quick. What complicates it this time is everybody's trying to use leverage. And the leverage is DACA. Mm-hmm. The Democrats are saying, hey, we're not going to give you the 60 votes because Republicans have 51 votes in the Senate, and they need nine Democrats to get up to the 60. We're not going to do that unless we use DACA. So what complicates it is Democrats are trying to use the spending bill as leverage, even though the March 5th deadline is over here.
But so, the thing about it, what Democrats are, what I'm hearing Democrats saying is that Republicans may not feel a sense of urgency, but there are a lot of kids that are already losing the permits. Some 122 Dreamers are losing their permits on a daily basis. So for them, obviously, it is a big deal because they're losing jobs, they're losing homes, they're at risk for deportation. And so for them, for the advocacy community, there is a sense of urgency.
Right.
And they're saying Democrats need to use their leverage. And like you said, it's through the budget process because Republicans are demanding that this be dealt with separately. But if it is, then there's little chance of getting a real DACA fix.
Right. And I'm one of those Democrats, and I'll say this, you know, I support DACA. I've been supporting this for a long time, but I'm not going to shut down the government for one issue. The Republicans did it over health care. You remember some years ago? That was wrong. We don't need to. I'm not going to support a shutdown of the government over a single issue, even though I emphasize that DACA is very important. But we need to still use that leverage to get the job done. The issue here is, can we get to the principles? And I'll talk about what happened at the White House. We said we're going to talk about four things. Mm-hmm. One is DACA. One is, and this is on top, that we still got to get those top numbers.
Yeah.
Because we got to get those top numbers. Once we get that, you'll see that our work will be done quickly because it's been done already. We worked on it last year. DACA, two, and I remember the Republicans kept saying the wall, and I said, no, it's called border security. And they agreed, okay, border security. And I'll get into the definition, what you start off with. The other one is chain migration. Is it chain migration changes to only DACA, or is it chain migration to everybody else?
And just to be clear, conservatives are using the rhetoric of chain migration to really talk about, you know, family reunification visas. You know, it was established in 1965, and now they're saying it's being abused. Let's stop it at some point because, you know, we need to have a better control of who gets into the country. So it's important to understand what we mean by that.
Chain migration, basically, one person comes in. Do they bring their immediate families or they bring their abuelos, los tíos, everybody else? So, you know, it's how far do you go on beyond? Because one person can bring in more than one individual, and it goes on a long time. And there are some of us are saying...
But what does the current law say right now? Is it just immediate family?
Family? It's extended family. It goes on. I mean, you know this very well because you've studied this, is that one person can bring in more than just the immediate family. And that person that comes in can later bring in. Now, does it take a long time? Yes. Now, to finish my thought, so the third thing was chain migration. The fourth thing was diversity, the lottery things. Some of us feel that maybe we need to look at the security a little bit more. And keep in mind that the lottery is has become an issue that's very important to not only the Hispanic caucus, but the Black caucus. Mm-hmm. Because the last time we looked at numbers, 41% of the lotteries were coming in from countries in Africa. So the Black Caucus has come in and said, oh, this is something that we have big interest in. And we saw a vote some years ago when this came up. So I bring up those issues, the four issues. So we said, okay, those four issues. Yesterday when I was talking to my Republican friends, they said, oh, by the way, we need to talk about this and this and this. So they brought in
the Securing America.
They're bringing in like 24 issues. I said, I thought there were four issues. And they said, well, border security covers it, sanctuary cities, Cates Law, and some of us have, you know, certain opinions on some of those. But they're not talking about four issues. Now they're talking about a whole bunch of issues.
Well, that particular bill, that's only one of many on the Hill.
They're all proposals.
But that one in particular, Democrats are saying, and advocacy groups are saying, you know, it's a non-starter because you have a lot of poison pills in there that Democrats and the immigrant community are just not going to accept in exchange for protection for the Dreamers. You know, that one has a 24-point plan, and it's a nativist wish list.
And the point is, there are extreme positions, with all due respect. The left have, you know, the left says all we want is a clean DACA bill, and that's it.
And you don't agree that that's possible?
Well, let me finish. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I mean, you know, first of all, Republicans control the Senate, the House, and the White House. If you count to 218, there are not 218 Democrats in the House, and we got to get away. DACA by itself is not going to happen. Now, on the other side, you got the people on the right that don't want to see DACA, want to add all those positions that you talked about. So you got two positions out there. At the end of the day, we work something out. The far left and the far right are not going to be happy. And it's going to depend on people in the middle, Democrats and Republicans, then put something forward to work it. And on top of that, if I can finish more, because it gets a little complicated, it's not only DACA. So we got to come up with those top numbers. We got to deal with DACA. I think what's going to happen is we're going to do a CR to mid-February, is what I think. I don't like it, but I think that's going to happen. Practically, I think that's going to happen. What happens in March? There's another big issue that we probably have to tie in. Anybody know? Debt ceiling. So somehow we're going to try to put all those things together to address those issues, whether together or separately. But I just want to give you the inside perspective in appropriations, looking at appropriations top numbers, looking at DACA, how do we use that as leverage on the spending bill, and the debt ceiling that will be coming in.
And so on that note, we want to toss it out to you guys for questions, comments. There are a lot of things going on behind the scenes, of course, and so we'll take first round of questions.
Yeah, thank you, Congressman, and thanks for the panel. Regarding your 20-yard strategy, mm-hmm. Which I think many of us could endorse, so many of the Central American migrants make it through Mexico on the railroads. On Ferro Mexico and other railroads. And I know this has been an issue that's been discussed between the U.S. government, Mexico, and the railroads as to how to ensure that they don't hitchhike on these trains, because this is the major, as I understand it, I might be wrong, the major artery that gets them to the U.S. border. Could you perhaps discuss that?
Anthony, well, I think he stepped out, but Anthony, it was called the Beast. There was a train that would come in from Central America, Mexico, called the Beast, where they would just jump in. And unfortunately, some of the times those folks would fall off, lose legs, get killed. So when we did that work with Mexico and the Southern strategy with Mexico, their Southern strategy, there was work on that to try to get them to stop those people from coming in. But keep in mind that if you think about it, the drug cartels they might be in drug cartels. I mean, they might be selling drugs, human trafficking or smuggling, and, you know, whatever makes money for them. They control routes. They control routes. And by controlling routes, that means that they have the area greased. That is, they got officials that are turning their heads, and they've got certain routes. So they'll be able to do it. I mean, think about this. when the Cubans were coming in, different issue, and I was in Central America, I said, hey, so are you, how did you go, how are you here in Costa Rica? Because we're in Costa Rica. They said, well, we went from Cuba to Ecuador, and then, you know, Colombia, Panama, ended up in Costa Rica. That's when Nicaragua said, no more. All right? And I said, where are you going? And I think I knew the question, or the answer already. They said, Laredo, Texas. I said, now tell me, how did you pick Laredo? If you're from Cuba, how do you go all the way, come to Laredo? And again, there is a smuggling. There's a way to get over here. And the smugglers are able to move people and drugs around. And if you think about the unaccompanied kids, how do the unaccompanied kids all of a sudden just go to South Texas? It's because they control routes. So it might be the rails, but there might be other ways of moving people over here. And I say that is because we got to understand what we're trying to do. The administration doesn't. Well, I think they have a lot of people that understand it, but certain voices are winning in the White House. And that's the thing is they just don't understand. For example, they say the border, it's violent, it's all this. If you look at the latest FBI statistics, and I do this every year just to show you. If you look at, for example, murder rates, and you mentioned this, which is very good. The annual national murder rate in the U.S. is 5.3 murders per 100,000. 5.3. If you look at McAllen, Brownsville, El Paso, Dorrio, Laredo, none of those are above that number. They're below. And I've always said, you know, hey, what's the most dangerous thing about being on the border? When I leave Laredo, Texas, I fly to Washington, D.C., because Washington, D.C. has more murders than my hometown of Laredo. If you look at the violent crime rates also, which is rapes, assaults, and all that, the national crime rate, you find it at the border lower than a national crime rate. So there's a lot of fallacies, and people just are using why the wall. It's a winning argument for the president. It's a winning argument, but it doesn't make sense because it wasn't a memo that they put out. It was their budget request to us, where they took money from the National Guard. They took money over there to build the wall, which is the most ineffective way of doing this. And I'll finish with this.
But I guess what he's trying to get at is, you know, obviously you talk about trying to find the middle ground and make it a win-win for everyone to address concerns about border security and to address the needs of the Dreamers and everyone else down the road, because the president also seems to be saying we're going to get to a comprehensive immigration reform in a second phase down the road. Obviously, a lot of conservatives didn't take that too well, and there were a lot of really nasty comments on Twitter against that. So I want to get to another question before we're done.
Thank you so much. Great presentation. So you mentioned, Congressman, that Mexico has the ability to be the matador at the southern border, their southern border. They're not doing it because they're just so dependent on NAFTA talks, et cetera. That doesn't change. My real question is to both of you on the panel, how important are the Mexican elections for the future of this relationship? Does it matter a lot from the U.S. perspective who is going to be the president?
It does, and it does, and for us, for some of us have been working with Mexico. Keep in mind that Mexico for many years was a very naturalistic country. I mean, they're very proud, and at the same time they have this relationship with the U.S. We want to be neighbors, but at the same time they haven't forgotten that the U.S. took 55% of the territory. And to them, and I'm serious. They have that in their mind. Imagine if some country took 55% of your territory, you would remember that like if it just happened yesterday. So for many years, especially in the 80s and the 90s, a lot of us were working on trying to get Mexico closer to us. We've gotten them to a part. Then the president comes in and starts pushing Mexico away. NAFTA is very important to us. Security is very important. They work with us on those issues on that. 40% of everything we export as a country, 40% of everything we export goes to Latin America, Mexico, Central, and South America. 40% of everything. But we don't treat them as neighbors. If you look at the world, there are some countries that don't have very friendly neighbors. We as the United States are blessed to have Canada and Mexico as neighbors. And we should take advantage of that. And when I said this, when some people see Russia as a friend and Mexico as an enemy, that world has been turned upside down.
One last question, because we're running out of time.
Hi. I work for the Thomson Reuters Foundation. We cover things like land rights, vulnerable people, trafficking, and such. So I'd like to ask you about the wall, but also the threat of the wall, and if you could address a little bit how that's had an impact or what sort of impact it's had on life along the border in, say, working conditions, labor conditions among both people without documents and also people who do have documents but might be frightened by the situation.
Vanda, you want to start that off?
Sure, and I would say it's not just the wall, but the broader rhetoric of the Trump administration, right. The raids among Latino communities, but not just Latino communities, the rhetoric against Muslim citizens, Muslim residents, has created a significant atmosphere of fear and, for many people, terror. We saw it immediately, of course, in the Houston hurricane disaster, where people, not only undocumented workers, but people who had families who were undocumented, were afraid to come to shelters, despite the efforts of local officials to encourage them to come to shelter. So you had a very immediate situation and people putting themselves and their families in dire risk for the fear of deportation. Of course, we spoke about Dreamers and the psychological difficulty for them. I do want to speak about crossing the border. I mentioned in my remarks that crossing the border is a matter of daily life for border communities. With the economy of particularly smaller U.S. cities and towns, not as large as Laredo or El Paso, but the smaller ones very much along the border depending on, in fact, people from Mexico coming there to buy goods on the daily basis. And the reverse also holds for people from the United States going to places like Ciudad Juarez or Tijuana.
And Vanda, we are talking about a very vital, very dynamic border community of some 12 million people, correct?
On the U.S. side. If we can extend it into Mexico, we end up with a larger community, in fact. And, you know, there is also the notion, I think, that's very antiquated, that the community is people within 100 miles in each direction. The reality today is, of course, that many people have families as far as Michigan and Wisconsin, very deep into the United States. So the notion of the border being somehow separate from the rest of the body of the United States fundamentally doesn't hold true. So yes, there are significant impacts, very negative impacts. And I want to go back to the point that Congressman Couillard and I were making before in multiple ways, that to think about border and border security, to think about the safety of the body of the United States, it's not only a matter of what happens here, what happens in the heart, what happens in the brain. It's about what happens in the external environment. How do we shape the external environment? How do we encourage cooperations with matters that matter to us? So, for example, antagonizing Mexican politicians, including some that already have perhaps nationalist, fairly anti-U.S. positions to start with, is not going to help. Is not going to help secure the United States. Is not going to make it a healthier, happier, more prosperous country.
So on that note, I do want to bring this to a close and wrap it up, and I'm going to give you guys a chance to do a one-minute pitch on what you envision to be would be a smart border security plan for the United States. Banda.
Not build the wall. Invest more money into improving legal ports of entry, not simply in terms of security, but also in terms of efficiency. That might include pushing security, such as container and cargo security, deeper into Canada and, importantly, deeper into Mexico, The Obama administration tried that, and there were some successful pilot projects. Far more can be invested. Invest money in people, officials, agents who work at the border, and do so in a way that improves their quality of life, but also assures vetting, not just mass increases in workforce without adequate training, vetting, and the resources they need. Put more money in Coast Guard. Don't take money away from Coast Guard. And conceive of the border as being part of a larger, of the body of the United States, as a part of a larger organic environment. The border is not just a line of separation with a structure on it. It is a membrane of connection. And that's how we should think about it.
Congressman, the last word.
When we look at the border, it's not only the southern border, it's the northern border, it's the coast that we have. And that's why we got to look at how things come in or how people come in or drugs come in. You got to understand that it's not only the southern border. It reminds me of the French and the Germans in World War One, where the French built this defense and the Germans just went around on the other side. So, I mean, you just got to understand how security works and how you stop it. Technology works very well. For example, aerostats, all you need is about 100 of the right aerostats and you can cover the whole border. And we already have surplus from the military that the taxpayers paid. And all we have to do it, because it'll cover 40 miles, and you're able to cover the whole border with about 100 of them. The personnel is also men and women in blue and green, not only Border Patrol, but CBP also, technology that's used well. You also got to look at, also keep in mind that if you add more Border Patrol, you create more activity. So you got to have judges, district judges. You got to have personnel, marshals, the other staff, it's support staff. I've added something that that nobody's done for a long time. I added 55 immigration judges a couple years ago. I added 25, but the Obama administration wanted zero, which is beyond me. But I told my Republican friends, forget about Obama, add those 25 judges. I got 65 judges now this year in the appropriations, and I intend to add a little bit more. Immigration judges are good because they will tell somebody, you stay, or unfortunately sometimes, you go. And you got to have that judge make that decision. Finally, the last thing is you got to understand what's happening in Homeland. Did you know that Border Patrol is losing more personnel than they're hiring personnel? At one time, we're at 21,500. Right now, we're at 18,500, maybe 19,000. And it's got to a point where the Trump administration is paying hundreds of million dollars to a private company to hire Border Patrol. So, I mean, what are we doing here, guys? What's wrong with this picture? And by the way, we got to understand demographics also. It's not a Homeland, Secret Service, CBP, and other folks. There is a large number of people that are trying to, that are going to be retiring, and we're not hiring enough people there. So we just got to make sure that when we look at diversity of immigration, a lot of those immigrants are going to be filling some of those positions that we're trying to hire right now.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us in this important and timely panel. Follow the news, and you know, you can follow us and ask additional questions through the Brookings Institution. We want to thank you for joining us. You have a great day.
Have a good job.